go to thecognitiverampage.com. Feel free to contribute, donate, keep fueling the change, whatever it is that you guys can do to help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support and, of course, your contributions. Love you.
Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. My book, The Cognitive Rampage, A Scientific Approach to Self-Discovery, Change, and Life Optimization, is now available on Amazon. What I do in the book is I fuse the latest research from the cognitive, behavioral, social, environmental, and biological sciences. It's not just motivational fluff and wordplay. Now, I do talk about my own story, so there's some kind of inspiration in there, but I'm not just spinning words and hyping you up with motivational fluff. Whether you need a life change, simply enjoy self-exploration and optimization, want to discover new hidden passions, or reduce the life-altering effects of toil, anxiety, depression, all of those issues, this book is for you. This book is not a cookie-cutter method of steps to follow. You'll customize the scientific framework with your own personal beliefs to build your authentic change. That way you assimilate it faster and quicker. It's not just copying my beliefs and telling you step one, step two. These will come from your beliefs as how you extend and build the foundation upon this framework. You'll use this framework throughout your whole life, through every change, and through every age. These are not empty words of motivational spin. This book is an experience. The Cognitive Rampage is based in science and is built from your beliefs. It's a path to help you unleash your desired change. You can apply this method on your own with no harmful side effects. You can simply go to Amazon.com, search The Cognitive Rampage, and you'll find the second edition there, as well as the Kindle version. The audiobook is going to be released sometime in June. Sometime in June, I will have the audiobook of the second edition available as well. Now, you can also mental train at cognitiverampage.com. You can mental train with me one-on-one, right? It's your own personal cognitive rampage. I do four types, really. I do mental training where I'm practicing with you in the present and I'm teaching you psychological tools and strategies to apply in your life in the present moment, in the now, right? We're not going to run through your childhood or cultivate or talk about the traumas that have impacted you over time. The idea is to handle in the present with tools and strategies that are effective and proven by science that you can do with yourself. Now, that's the first part of mental training. The second part that I do is I do minimalist training. I'm a minimalist. I live that lifestyle. And a lot of people, well, they want to, but they're not sure. What I help you do is I coach you through what to expect, down to what to get, and what you'll go through, even where to start. So we do minimalist training as well. And the third type of training I do is book and podcast training, meaning help you write the book, tell you what's included, what to expect, what you got to go through, some tricks of the trade that I learned publishing my two books, as well as if you have a podcast, if you're just starting out with a podcast and you want to do well on social media, right? You want to get the rankings, you want to learn more about it, how to do it, down to the gear that you need, what you should expect, and again, some tricks from the trade that I've learned through the Cognitive Rampage podcast, I'm more than happy to share with you. And that leads to my last bit of training, which is social media. I teach you what you need, how to get it started, and show you how to run it yourself, all right? So mental training is available. That's at adamlowry.com as well. The author that's on the show today, Christian Hall, his book, Rise from Darkness. I like that. And it has a beautiful phoenix on the front. Actually, my cousin Jesse has a really cool phoenix tattoo that I love. And I love the cover of the book, too. It matters to me. It pulls you in a little bit for sure. But it's about rising from darkness and finding paths away from depression and toward happiness. And that book is also on Amazon. I appreciate you coming on the show, Christian. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I read a lot in the mental health field, being a counselor myself and staying in it. And we have people on the show many times that share their stories of what they went through. But you actually wrote a book on what you went through.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was reading through the beginning, and to stay, I hate saying optimistic, but even in the beginning of your story, you kind of approach it with, you know, this happened, but I still feel this way. It was strong. And one of the metaphors that gets me in the beginning is you referred to depression as a staircase. And I thought to myself about you, where were you on that staircase when you kind of realized it was one?
Yeah, exactly. I think I was probably on my way up. Because, you know, when you're down there, when you're really down in the cellar, you're not really able to think clearly at all, right? So you're just down in there in that soup of pain. And I think that in order to start climbing the ladder, you need to realize first and foremost that what's actually happening to you, that you have this disease, and that it is a disease. It's not normal. It's not supposed to be like that. And then also to understand that there's so many things you can actually do to climb out of it, huh?
Yeah, I like the approach from the very beginning, but the idea that we all experience it on some level in our life and how we get through it, whether we consider it, I wondered, was acknowledging what it was important to you?
I think it was because, you know, for the first years that I was in this hell, I didn't understand at all that there was something wrong to me. I just lived in this pain and I thought that this was normal. I thought it would be like this forever. And I had absolutely no hope that things would actually start improving. So I think that the first phase is to understand what you are in, and then you can start climbing.
Yeah, and unlike a lot of stories that you see where people are talking about how they're experiencing depression kind of in a more of adult age, you went, was it 11 years almost, spanning from childhood into young adulthood?
Yeah, it was 11 years. I think I started in when I was 14, and then I kind of looked upon myself as well again, you know, when I was way up in my 20s.
So that's almost a decade of... What would you say, you acknowledged it for 10 years and dealt with it, or was it more undercover for you for about 5 years and then acknowledgement, or was it just 10 straight years of knowing exactly what it was?
I think I can, if I tell the short story, I mean, for me, it started when I was 14, because when I was 14, I lost my father, who was himself struggling with depression and anxiety and also some addiction issues. And he was living very hard, and he then passed away. And of course, I love this guy very much, and I still do. And when you lose someone you love that much, you, of course, you go into grief. But I wasn't able to get up again. I kind of stayed down, and what started out as a normal grief then morphed into depression, and it got worse and worse. And I reached the stage when I just wanted to die. Mm. And then I continued to live in the pain for many years. And I think it wasn't until I was finally persuaded to seek counseling that I understood what was actually happening to me, and that I had a diagnosis and that had a name. And from that moment on, I was able to start the improvement work to get well again.
Yeah, there's a few things that I consider difficult to undertake as a counselor. And one of those is losing a child and a parent dealing with that. And another is losing a parent early and being 14, losing a father like that. I can see where the pain and where it would push you down, the loss. I mean, it's a harsh way to greet how unfair life really can be. And to follow through with a counselor, even how old were you when you sought out the therapy?
I was around 19.
So, man, that's young still. There's so many young kids that avoid it for so long, just thinking it's a part of life, and it gets harder and harder to deal with it. And being so cognizant, I think, or aware, maybe were you feeling more or less like, so fine, I'm willing to do anything?
I think it was a result of my mother and sister pestering me about going to therapy for years on years. And finally, they got through to me and I did it. And that was, of course, the starting point of my improvement process.
Where was the first, what was the application? I hate to get specific, right? Because help to me is help. I hate being so specific and, you know, it was this or that. But where did you seek out first? Where did basically that first step that you took on that staircase to come up, what was it?
I think it was, you know, the therapist that I was assigned. I mean, he was a great guy. And I think the most important thing he did for me was to help me sort out my very complex feelings and my very complex sorrow over my father. Because I was, you know, in therapy, it was the first time ever that I allowed myself to be really angry with him. And I think that was very healthy for me. It was a stage I had to go through in order to be able to progress. So I think that was really the beginning to handle that sorrow and kind of take out the skeletons from the closet, etc.
Can you walk me through how you got that anger out? What were some of the applications? What did you do? Where did you start to do that? How?
I mean, I think when you lose a parent, you start idolizing the person you lost, right? I mean, there's this love, and all you can allow yourself is to feel the love and to remember the person that passed away in a positive light. But of course, I mean, that's not going to help you in the end, because you also need to relate to the dark side of the relationship, right? So I think it was not really specific techniques that my therapist was using. It was more just talking it through over 2 years. And it was after, let's say, the years in therapy that I started, you know, using concrete techniques, you know, from cognitive behavioral therapy and positive psychology in order to get 100% well and not only, you know, partially well.
So a lot of the cognitive techniques are where I like to start too, is starting with what you believe, what you think, how you see it, how you perceive it. But I thought it was interesting. The first part that you mentioned is sometimes what I call to is like purging, is, you know, getting that out, getting the, maybe not even realizing how angry we might be when something like that, when we experience it and it holds us down. But the cognitive approach always seems to be a good place to start. What were some behavior changes? What did your behavior get to the point to where what changed with it?
Yeah, I think, I mean, when I was, if you call it the phase two, when I was using the cognitive techniques and the positive psychology techniques, what I was working with was to improve my thinking, basically, because I had my mind full of these, logical fallacies that a lot of people with depression have. And I thought, for example, that whatever bad happened in the world around me had something to do with me, right? Which is, of course, just bullshit. But you need to work systematically with some of these techniques to understand that. And I also thought that whenever somebody would say something, that would be then a criticism against me, which, of course, it wasn't. I was thinking so badly in those years, man. It was crazy.
Yeah, a lot of people talk about, you know, what to think and just thinking positive. And sometimes that's good a lot of the time, I should say. But sometimes letting those thoughts come out, right? And when we hear those come out of what we're saying and what we're really believing, we sometimes can really look at them and go, wait, how am I looking at the world? You know, what am I expecting? What's really going on inside my head?
Yeah.
It sounds like you took that adventure kind of in the mind itself. Now, was it difficult questioning what that experience felt like for you? You know, being 14 and just five years later, 19, 20, was it difficult to question and try to reframe? Because a lot of people talk about reframing. That's kind of what I was mentioning in the beginning, is it's not so much what we think, but how we think, right? We can think positive a lot, right? We can say, well, this is positive. But if how we're thinking over time is really detrimental to what we're doing, not just what we're thinking, right?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. No, I think this was an amazing voyage. It was a very painful voyage as well. But to me, it was an amazing voyage to understand that it's actually possible to teach yourself to think in an entirely different way, and to think in a way which is, you know, something closer to being objective, and thinking in a way which is clear of these logical fallacies. So I think it was just after a time I was able to start enjoying it and to understand that this doesn't only, you know, concern me, but it concerns all people, because all people, they are thinking in these erroneous ways, and most people, if not all, would be benefiting so much from teaching themselves to think in a much more objective and rational way. So I think it was a roller coaster. It went up and down, and it was still painful from time to time, but it was an amazing experience. And I think the great stuff is that it doesn't end, you know? I mean, once you're up walking this ladder, you can just continue and and find happiness, you know, and whatnot. So it's great.
Yeah, I read on that you have found your dream life, if you will, where you were living and what you've come to. It's you even reference in the book, you know, this is a story we all experience. It's what we tend to walk through, most of us, but you can come out. It was very supportive the way it read. It was like, look, I'm human, I'm with you, and here's what I've discovered on my journey here.
Yeah, thanks. I think you need the kind of books which are written by, you know, PhD and guys that have, you know, read thousands of books and articles on psychology and what works. You need those kind of books. But I think you also need the kind of books which are written by more the layman and also the people that have been down there in the cellar and know how it is. Because if not, then you can get this distance and it gets really hard for the people that are afflicted to start working with themselves. Huh?
I would agree. I think a lot of times people, researchers specifically, get caught up more in the jargon of what the research says than what the moment is like to the individual, and how most of our lives we tend to experience something on a similar pattern, but we can't really understand each other because we're not each other. But knowing and hearing, I think, in detailed voices you wrote, what that journey was like for you. I can even hear it now, the way you reframe the journey. It's very epic hero, right? It's like, yeah, I had to go into the darkness. I had to rise from it, right? Perfect title, actually.
Yeah, thanks. No, it's true. And I checked out some of your other podcasts. And I like this kind of reframing the story of your life that you're talking about. And this heroic perspective I like very much. And I think that you can use that very much to exit depression. Because you can then say that, okay, my part of my life was hell, you know, but I can now use this in the purpose of good, and I can help other people that are struggling, and I can do that because I was down there in the basement. So I really like that.
I appreciate it, man. I was thinking, what was the toughest part, right? The time span doesn't really matter about how long it took you to kind of recover from that, but can you remember looking back where some things that sound easy, like you and I talk about reframing or something, or changing how you think, any path along the way, or any episode along the way, can you remember being the most difficult for you?
Yeah, I think there are several, actually, moments. I remember one moment when I was sitting in my room. I was a student at the time, and I was sitting on the floor, and I remembered feeling and thinking very vividly that this is the bottom. This is rock solid bottom. In a way, that was where it all began for me, because I understood that it actually can't get worse now, you know? Yeah. That was an amazing moment. So in a way, that was not a hard moment. But I think that the hardest moment for most people is right before you decide to do whatever you can to fight this damned illness. And once you've decided, then it gets easier. And that's what I try telling people that want to listen to me, that even if you feel like shit, and even if you don't have any hope, if you can simply decide to do some things, it doesn't need to be a lot at all, but just a few things, then you can start the work, and then it will be easier from that.
That belief and that just starting to change. I think that moment, a lot of people talk about a process through something and trying to reframe the past, et cetera. But I think a lot of the time I find, even with myself in my own life, the hardest thing to do is the cognitive dissonance, is to get by the denial of what that is or what it could be, acknowledge that, but then be willing through that question to question your own experience, to question your own history, your own interpretations, your own perceptions, to question those personal truths. I think is that, for me, has always been the most difficult part, but also, like you said, the most exploratory fun part.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just, you get me going, man. And I try to stop talking as much. I mean, you wrote the book and you just, as you're talking through it, I think about certain people, that have struggled, you know, that experience depression, even myself, not too long ago, was dealing with some anxiety with some things going on in my life. And I felt it important to do the acknowledgement, like you're saying, is to point out, okay, because I think when you acknowledge it, would you say that that's the time we're choosing to do something about it?
Mm. Yeah, I think it's really critical. And I think it's like Tim Ferriss wrote in one of his books that if you want to start exercising, right, what you commit to is you do one push-up every day, nothing more. Huh? And if you suffer from depression, you can commit to walking for 1 minute, you know, every day. And I think that's really crucial, that you really, really start out small. You start with those baby steps that you can be sure that you will manage whatever mood you may be in that day. And that's great, you know, if you can do that. If you can walk for 1 minute, that's a great start, and then you can build on that. And if you want to use your various techniques, you know, then you can do ABC, for example, once per day, and that's also a great start. Or you can do your gratitude journal if you want to learn from the positive psychology. And I think that's really critical, that you just start in the small and you build from there.
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point, because even those that deal with addiction, depression, et cetera, maybe you could walk through it in your experience of it. But the idea where we have this false recovery, this we woke up on a Tuesday and we say, okay, today, you know, it does happen, but we go, today I'm happy, everything's changing, I'm never using again, or I'm not going to be sad. Today we go out and it's going to be okay. And you just try to walk through the day in that falsehood and try to change everything in your life. You change your behavior, you leave a relationship, you try everything at once, right, to try to fix the outside before you're fixing here. And, you know, for you, can you relate to the idea of what you're saying is the baby steps versus this massive change at once?
Yeah, I think it's really important, because if you do like what you just described, and you think that, hey, I'm feeling good today, it must mean that my life is fixed now, right? Then you're gonna hit the next crisis, you know, the next day or something like that, and then you might fall even lower than what you were when you started out. So I think that's also really important to be aware that this takes time. I mean, in most cases, it takes time. You need to build brick by brick, and you need to be ready also for having some steps back. Huh? So, yeah, start in the small and be ready also that there will be adversity and some you know, hindrances in the future, and then I think you can succeed.
Yeah, I think it starts to be overwhelming for those that have felt depression. Myself have gone through it before as well, is when you're kind of down already, beating yourself up, and then life happens just regularly, right? Shit just happens in life. Plus you're already feel down. It can really start to combine to feeling like the whole world is coming down on me. It's selecting just me, right? We can begin to say there's something wrong with me, this cursed idea. I think can really manifest too if we choose to stay down there. But I think what you said is important, is acknowledging the life adversity, that just because you're deciding to turn it around, you know, be prepared that life is still not going to stop, right? We still got to keep moving forward and try new things in our lives, right?
Yeah, exactly.
How much of socializing and re-socializing was a part of what you experienced on your path out of depression?
I think I needed to teach myself the social life all over again, because I've reached a stage where I basically took everything as a personal affront from people. And of course, when you treat people like that, they get fed up and they distance themselves from you. So for several years there, I had zero friends, or at least I had some friends, but they didn't want to spend time with me because I've turned out to be a bad person. So I needed to relearn how to handle people, and I needed to be able to trust being in the social situation again, because I had quite a lot of social anxiety as well. So I really needed to work on my social skills for several years, actually, in order to get back. And of course, again, I can reframe that in a positive way and say that that's great, because then I know how you can do that, right? Because that the same situation applies to a lot of other people. Sometimes you actually have to relearn how to treat other people in a good way. And it's possible, and that I think it's good news.
Yeah, I agree with you. Speaking of having friends around, I wish I could remember her name. It was a doctor this morning on a podcast I listened to, and she was talking about new research was showing that if you're a person that is constantly living in the optimism, if you're constantly not taking things as big deals, that actually certain friends begin to even stay away from you because you have this empathy gap is what she called it. So this idea that when you're not acknowledging that, you know, you're sad or someone else is sad and being in it with them and simply moving beyond it, that you actually create a social gap that those that try to live like that, cause it is difficult, right? I thought it was interesting that she, you know, I was like, I have to talk to this lady. I need to know, I need to know more about that.
Exactly. And I think that's a really good point. And the thing, one of the key social skills that people can use is to shift the focus from yourself and over to the other person that you are relating to. Because if you do that, and if you, for example, if you really listen to what other people are saying, then you can feel and sense and hear, for example, that this and this person doesn't really react well to my hyper optimism, right? So you can tone that down. And you can be at a more neutral level, which will cross over to that other person in a better way. So I think focusing on the other guy or girl is really key.
I think it's important. I think you're kind of talking a little bit about empathy. It's the idea of, you know, really, it's hard not to look outside of self when we're feeling depressed, but to literally turn that around and socially listen to more people and I think open yourself up and show empathy. I think when we can show empathy toward other people, maybe that somehow allows us to be empathetic toward ourselves, maybe so we can move forward rather than kind of stay on that martyr spiral, if you will. Did you experience that in depression? I know when I experienced it, I went through this martyr where I'll go down with the ship. I'll weigh it all for everybody else. You know, one day they'll see this kind of martyrism.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, definitely. I was using self-pity, self-medication, if you will. I mean, it was my something to hold on to, but it's not a good thing to hold on to. Self-pity is really bad. So at some stage, you need to throw that in the waste bin. I think it's not easy, but it can be done. And I think, you know, you can focus more on other people, and a good way to do that is to focus on helping other people. And that's also something that research shows is really helpful if you want to get in a better mood, right?
Hey, you're gonna build friends quickly. I can say that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. And that's, of course, I mean, it's a big drawback with all this thing with social media, etc. Is you build distance between people, huh? And I think that we need to reinvent society in a way. I mean, social media is great. That's how we met each other. But I think we need to get back to at least spending part of our time being face to face and helping out with real issues, you know, in real life, and getting away from the screen sometimes because it's not the best.
Yeah, I write in my book, Dr. Carl Hart said it, which is people in your proximity. You know, if you can help people in your physical proximity, and we all tend to do that around the world, then maybe we can help out. You know, I had a few questions that I wanted to get into. The social part, did you ever feel socially connected from 14 forward as you went through depression? And do you think that had a lot to do with the addition of not being socially connected or accepted?
Oh, I mean, I was very lonely, you know, from I was 14 and way into my 20s, I think. Because I had to relearn how to treat people. And when I was able to do that, then I was able to socially connect with people again. So I was very much socially disconnected for many years. And of course, that's something that worsens the illness, right? It's kind of interlinked with depression, this kind of social disconnect. And that's, again, also connected to the martyrdom spiral that you talk about. So, and that, I mean, that's how it is. I mean, it's an illness with so many factors which are interlinked and self-strengthening. And you need to break those cycles in a way. And the good news is you can do that from many different angles.
Yeah, I think what we lose when we experience, you know, I was reading your book, a part that hit home for me was, you never really knew what dad to expect. You know, you loved him, but you never really knew. And, you know, that's, I come from a similar home, at times. And when we have to live, I think people don't recognize that that becomes a state of hypervigilance, that we're in this state of holy shit all the time, which is very linked to PTSD. But I think what we lose young is trust. Is if we can't trust our own parent, right, or parents, whatever it may be, if we don't, if they can't even be around, how can we trust anybody? And I think the way we socially connect is by being vulnerable, like you said, with others and open. But if we don't trust anybody, there's no way I'm socially connecting with you.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's really true, and that's something that you can only relearn by daring to trust, right? I mean, and when you dare to trust, you also need to be ready to be disappointed by people from time to time. And you need, and that's also connected to the cognitive techniques, that you need to understand that it's not so that you either cannot trust anyone or you can't trust absolutely anyone. It's something in between, right? I mean, some people can be trusted most of the times and some people are not really trustworthy, right? And you can only learn those things in kind of daring to trust people and then accepting that sometimes you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah, that was, I think that was one of the longest battles for me was, although my father provided some good things in my life to where I wanted to be, you know, proud of this or thankful for that, at times it was hard to look by, you know, the years of living in that hypervigilance. And I mean, I'll spare the details, but that idea first had to happen, I think, when I had empathy, when I could find empathy for what he experienced or had been experiencing. And like you said, really acknowledge the idea of the irrational statement that you covered, right? Is that, well, no one is to be trusted, right? We base that on, well, if a parent can't be trusted, well, then no one can. And that absolute, you know, keeps us blocked off. Those are some of the, of my difficult things is facing that. But for you, it seemed like you held that optimistic love for your father the entire time, no matter what.
I did. I was idolizing him. I mean, he was sunshine and shadow, right? This guy, I mean, there was never any violence or stuff like this, but it's just frightening when your dad is really, really intoxicated. But he was also a great guy, you know? So for some reason, I was just holding on to all those sunshine stories and kind of putting the darkness way at the back of my subconscious.
I think that's important, though. It seems like a really big part of your walk or your path toward happiness, like you write about, is dealing, like you said in the beginning, with the anger of that, the loss of the connection, but facing what those were and being able to see your father. I think that's a heck of a superpower, man, along the way to still to love like that, man.
Yeah, thanks. I think it's important. Huh? I mean, we're all flawed in some way. And if we can just accept that and accept that we're flawed ourselves, then that's okay. And then you can start focusing on all those strengths and positive aspects that people have. And then your life is going to be much more fun.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to jump biologically speaking. How was when you were 14, et cetera, up into your early 20s, what changed biologically speaking? Not the obvious, but what we were eating or how much activity, et cetera. Walk me through what it was like in the depression in the beginning, before depression and after it.
Yeah, I think both my nutrition situation and then exercise situation was really, really bad. I was not focusing on what I was eating or what I was drinking. I didn't sleep well. That's, of course, connected to depression. And I was very rarely exercising or getting outdoors or anything. And now I would say I'm addicted to it because I know that there's this strong connection to both what you eat and drink and also to what you do, you know. I mean, if I go for a long walk in the forest, it's basically impossible for me to be in a bad mood. And that has been, you know, shown by research and again for so many times. So it's there are all these things you can do connected to being outdoors in the wilderness and exercising and eating well. And it's really cool, I think, to explore all those options that you have and see what it does to your mood and to your feeling about yourself.
Yeah, I think we're talking, it's a change on all levels, right? I think a lot of times people approach and go, okay, I'm going to think differently maybe. They apply the cognitive psychology and they think differently, but they behave kind of the same and they change nothing about biology. They don't change social circles. Then you find that relapse, right? Then somebody changes social circles, does the whole exterior change, but then keeps the same biology, keeps the same internal thinking, et cetera. And rather than using all of it, how key was your change in your path to finding the happiness you have now was using all those elements as opposed to one or two?
Yeah, I think I kind of started upside down because whenever I talk to people that are depressed and I give advice or I write or something, then I actually start with exercise. You know, from a very, very low level, I say walk a minute a day or 5 minutes a day and you can step up from there. But I actually started more on the cognitive side. And I think that in many ways is harder because, I mean, cognitive techniques can be easy if you have a good tutor, right? If you have a good person that can teach you these things or a good book or something. But in many cases, you don't. And if you kind of self-study as I did, I think that was a bit hard. And I think it's easier to beat depression if you start the opposite direction. You start with the biological stuff, as you say. You start with the food and you start with the exercise. And then you can gradually go into the more mental stuff with the cognitive techniques and everything.
Yeah, I think there's a book on that. I think it's called The Cognitive Rampage, a scientific... I'm pretty sure that there's a book that actually starts with nutrition, but starts in the cognitive world, right? That willingness to question our own perceptions and our own beliefs to make a change. And was there one belief that kept you low on the stairs through all of it? Was there one belief that you just, it was hard for you to let go of?
I think that my belief about myself, my notion of self-worth was extremely low. Huh? I looked upon myself as shit that didn't deserve anything and that could never be loved or could never have friends or never succeed with anything. So I think that was a tough demon to slay, if you want, and something I had to work on for years. And I also think that belief is not something that vanishes overnight when you actually succeed tackling it, but it's something that gradually fades away. And that's why it can take time. But again, if you're prepared for that, then it's okay.
Mm. Yeah, that belief of self can hold so many back, right? In any moment over time, I know, shoot, the belief that I wasn't dealing with anxiety when I was dealing with it was strong enough to keep me back from even questioning that that's what I was going through. And, you know, the belief of self, I think, was some of my strongest points that helped me along the way. And having a lack of that, I think it's difficult, right? Because if we look at value of self based on how we perform, and then we use our history to validate how we've performed, and that's all we do to conjure up who we are, what we're worth. And if, let's say, we perform badly at school or task society tells us to, well, it's really hard, right? Not to be the judge and go, well, fuck, look at my history. It's shit. Of course I'm shit. I deserve shit, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's where I think that one of these techniques that you were talking about is really useful. If you can then reframe your life story from, you know, just a victim and from a loser to a, you know, a fighter, to a mountaineer, you know, who's facing the struggles, but who is climbing towards something which is much, much better. I think that's a really powerful exercise.
Yeah, you've dropped a couple here. You know, for you, I'm going to reference maybe like the staircase still. I'm going to keep it with you. When you were probably steps away from the life that you have now, whatever you reference as being a step, right? What was your routine like? Walk me through like your weekly or even your daily of when you were really winning, right? When you were like, holy shit, I'm a couple more steps away. I just met my wife I hope I marry her one day, right? You're in that world. What was your whole routine like?
Yeah, I think I was in those years in which I was progressing rapidly, I think I was spending a lot of time outdoors. And that is a routine and a habit that I just kept with. And then now I actually get, I forgot the word, but I really feel it when I do not have access to the wilderness and to the outdoors, because I've in a way developed a positive addiction to it. So I think that was a big part of my routine. Another big part was constantly questioning my own thought. And that, of course, is coming from the cognitive techniques. And all the time, if I relapsed into thinking badly about myself, I would then start, Socratic questioning, for example, and then asking critical questions as to, is that really a rational way to think? Is it the correct way to think? So I was really getting those techniques into a habit. I was also using quite a lot of gratitude techniques, using my diary to note down things in my life that I am really grateful about. So I think that is probably the three main pillars. So outdoors, gratitude, and then questioning my errant thought patterns.
And at the time, were you building a social circle at the same time? What was the social growth like?
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I mean, I was kind of partially finding my way back to childhood friends and partially gaining new ones. And it's of course amazing when you've spent so many years down in a hellhole to start seeing growth in all areas of your life. Huh? It's fantastic, and it's the greatest motivation you can have to continue that work.
Yeah, man. What led you, and how far along from writing the book, right? What was the inspiration, if you will, for the book? Was walk me through when you wrote the book, how that was like too, but was there an inspirational moment? Did you decide? What was that like?
Yeah, I think, so along the way, I started, taking notes. And that when I read a book about cognitive techniques, for example, I would be taking notes. And whenever I had an epiphany about something which is important, I would take notes. And gradually, I had a lot of notes. And I realized that, hey, I'm getting kind of a layman's expert on this topic. And I need to write a book. I need to take my fragments and edit it into a book. And that took me 10 years. And it's funny because I recently finished the final draft of my second book, and that took me 3 months. So that has been really cool. I think the first book was really tough to write, and the second book was just a game.
Yeah, well, you went through the fire the first time. 10 years to put out Rise, and then 3 months to what's the name of the new book?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I'm Norwegian, so I write in Norwegian. And this one, the second book, is going to be published by a publisher. So it will be up to them what happens to the translated edition. So I haven't really started thinking about the English title yet.
All right. Well, keep me on the lookout for it. So was there to write that book, though? Was it a span? How long? You said 10 years to write it, to organize it, to get that story out, right? To kind of, were you waiting on finishing the story? Or, because I went through it, too. I call writing your first book a lobotomy. All right. Because, like, it's people are like, it's easy. Just write it down. I'm like, look, look. Okay. Trying to get that information out in some, I don't know, understandable order of some kind, right? And was going through that almost like reliving it for you as you wrote the book?
I think also because it took me 10 years, I think I was at that time fairly far away from my bad years. So I think it was much more, looking up and forward than looking back and down. I think I was spared of reliving it.
It's a good feeling. I think, I had a journal that I helped write my book that I kept for like 20 years, and being able to look back over that, you mentioned keeping notes over the time to do it. And I mean, I was like, imagine that. I tracked all the shitty times in my life and a few of the good times, right? And being able to look over that, and that really helped write the first book for me, really. I ended up burning that shit, though. After I wrote the book, I kind of burned the journal, this little seance thing, right? Just kind of moving past it. And but being able to look back, though, on how you perceived your life at that time, right, in that mind frame, in that zone, how important or what would you tell somebody about keeping track or notes or journaling along their rise from the darkness, if you will?
Yeah, I think it's critical. I think it's really critical because first you need to understand that something's wrong, right? And then you need to understand what is wrong. And in order to get to understand that, you need to take notes. I think it's actually no way around it. I mean, you can use voice notes, right, if you don't like writing stuff. But I think it's really important to have somewhere where you store those epiphanies about yourself and the errant ways that you are thinking and behaving. Because if you don't, it's going to be much harder to learn from it.
Yeah, I would agree. I think everyone has a book in them. I think their life is a story, right? And I try to tell them, right, look at your life as like a story. And look, from what I understand, I don't control how this shit ends. I'm just going to not wake up one day or be blindsided by a bus on Tuesday or some shit. I can't control the end of this thing, but I can write the next page, right? I can control at least what happens next, man.
Yeah, I feel agree.
Yeah, and I encourage anybody, you know, to share their story and write that down. And I wonder, what would you say to that person maybe that's still on the bottom end of that stairwell, maybe in the basement of it, right? Sitting on that rock bottom floor like you were, right, when you talked about saying this is fucking it. You know, what would you say to that person sitting in that place right now?
I think that it's so important that you realize that there is hope. Because I'm no kind of superhuman. I'm just like you. And you can definitely, you know, improve the situation. You can get well from this, or at least much, much better. And all you need to do is to decide to do something, and then you take baby steps. That's it.
Yeah, we spoke about the baby steps in the beginning. I couldn't agree more. You know, a lot of those things sometimes people don't recognize until you're there, until you wake up one day going, okay, I'm breaking depression or anxiety right now. I'm never going to be nervous again, or I'm never going to be sad again, of what it really feels like then to overwhelm yourself, but really to step back and say, hey, do the one thing. I love your idea with the walk too. I mean, that helped me when I was with anxiety. I'm like, I got to walk now. I would just take this walk and
And
be outdoors. I seem to see this very common thread from people that experience depression, anxiety, etc., even addiction, about being outside and what that does to us, especially sunlight too. Dr. Jack Cruz would love to hear that. I think the addiction to that is good. I think that's a biological link, actually, is what we're discovering more, that it really does change us.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Has a huge effect, man. And I think your story is inspiring. I think it encourages others to share theirs, to relate to someone that necessarily is in it. It was a lot like me, dude, where I was like, I want to save my own fucking life here. So I'm going to go become a counselor. I'm going to become a therapist. I want to learn this shit and dive into it and fix myself, or at least learn and understand. You know, I was willing to go, God knows how much student loan and debt to do so. And, you don't have to do that, people. You don't have to become a counselor, right, or experience it. Be aware that we do experience it, right, and we can get out of it.
Yeah.
Hey, man. When the second book comes out, what's it about anyway? We don't have a title. What's the second book about?
You know, it's kind of the first one, the Rise from Darkness, is a menu, you know, of all sorts of techniques and mitigating measures and behaviors you can do to improve. The second one is more like a program. So it's a program in 14 steps, and like yours, starts with nutrition, starts with exercise, with those kind of measures, and then gradually goes into gratitude techniques and also meditation, cognitive techniques, self-hypnosis, which has been a great help to me. So that's what it is. It's a 14-step program.
Oh, I like the idea of the menu, of the idea of going, okay, here's one, here's two, here's three, here's what to use. Here's your arsenal, if you will, rather than a lot of fluff in between it. So, and for me, anybody that's writing on how to overcome depression, anxiety, and here's tools and publishing and putting together, you know, that list of here's your attack weapons, et cetera. I'm a fan of all that. I think we need more of that. We need more people's experience of what their climb out of darkness was, or even what their experience is like in the darkness, right? And sharing that with some of us, man. So when that book is ready, man, please feel free, come back on. I'd love to chat in depth with you about it, man.
Yeah, that would be cool for sure. I'll do that.
Yeah, how long do you got? What do you got? 2 months, 2 years, 10 years? How long?
I mean, it's a bit frustrating because the book is ready and has been, you know, for some time. But that's when you work with these publishing houses, they have their time slots, right? So they're like, okay, we're going to do this in a year. And I'm like, what? Oh, a year? That's an eternity in my life.
good for you, though, that it's already done, right? The lobotomy is over. You've extracted the words and put them on paper then.
Yeah, I did.
That's the hardest part, man. I finished the second edition, so I'm writing the third one sort of intermittently in my head sometimes. I'm like, when you do decide to dive in, though, it's you're like, all right, I'm going to go underwater for a while. I'll see everyone back in my life at some point when I return from regurgitating this, man.
Yeah, exactly. It's an interesting process.
Yeah. You know what I do? I am interested in the last question, man, is what's your writing process like? Do you have a ritual? Do you have a time frame? What's it like for you?
So I've been doing my stuff after work, right? So I've been having my day job and I've been writing in not so much mornings, but evenings and weekends. And I've had some good trips, you know, when I take a writing vacation and I go to the mountains and I just sit down and write for 3 days straight. And I hope sometime to have like a daily routine when I don't need to do those kind of special arrangements.
I love that you go out in nature and do it, man. My routine's weird, man. I don't think it's a daily routine. It'd be great maybe if I followed like the greats like Stephen Kotler, Tim Ferriss, and got up at, you know, 5:30 and started writing right at the most creative flow time, which they're right. I'm not going to doubt. Yeah. I wake up in the morning, whatever first task I put myself on, for some reason, I am really dedicated to that task.
Exactly.
In the morning, man. But I, like you, I'll just, to finish these last couple of books, man, I went to a pretty shitty part of town, kind of where I used to live, and, got a old room that I used to sell drugs out of back when I was, in my young 20s. And I got the exact room. I kept the card, actually. It's around here somewhere, the sign-in card. And I finished the book right then and there. It's kind of weird, man. We all got our rituals, right?
Yeah, we do.
Oh, man. Well, please keep writing, man. And when the book's ready, come back on. And I appreciate you sharing your story here and bringing what you experienced, bringing your tools for everybody and your philosophy, if you will, man. I'm sure a lot of people will get some love from it and listening to your story.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. And good luck also with your new books, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I think I'm going to be like the decade one on this one. I think I'm on my 10-year term for this, the third book, which is Athlete's Depression. That's going to be a while. All right, brother. I appreciate you coming on, man.
Thanks a lot. Have a good day, huh?
You too, buddy. Take care.
Bye.